Thanks for joining us. I'm Frank Sesno, host of Planet Forward online and as seen on PBS, and director of the School of Media and Public Affairs at the George Washington University, sitting in for Diane Rehm today. Journalists Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudun say attitudes today toward the routine abuse of women in poor countries around the world are similar to views once commonly held about the Atlantic slave trade 200 years ago. In a new book, they describe how forced prostitution, gender-based violence, and maternal mortality cripple not only women and girls, but societies at large. The book is called Half the Sky. Pulitzer Prize-winning writers Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudun join me now to talk about helping the world by helping women. And let me start first by welcoming you both to the Diane Rehm Show.
It's great to be here.
Thank you so much.
Well, it's a great pleasure and honor to have you both here. And let's start by talking about this book, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. But this book, as I mentioned, it's about women, but it's more than about women.
Absolutely. If it were only women following women's issues, we'd be sunk. Nothing would be solved. But the idea really is that women, if you educate and empower women, bring them into the labor force, they can really be one of the best ways to help end poverty and fight extremism.
You write that that from the World Bank to the Joint Chiefs of Staff to CARE, that the most effective way to fight global poverty and extremism is to address this issue of impoverished, virtually enslaved women. What do you mean?
Well, I think one thing we're waking up to is that this is not only a financial issue and not only a way to fight poverty. And for example, if you look at East Asia, one of the essential elements of East Asia's economic boom was to take girls who were out in the countryside, young women, and who were contributing negligibly to the economy, and then educate them, empower them, and really make them a buttress of industrialization. But on top of that, what we're now seeing is this as a security issue, and that one of the reasons that a number of countries from Afghanistan to Pakistan are so prone to civil violence, to conflict, to terrorism, is that women are completely marginalized. And the Pentagon in particular has really woken up to this.
It's kind of like when you're in a society where women are not part of the mainstream, what's left is men. And if you have a bulge of young men, it takes on the atmosphere of a men's locker room. And so you have a surge in violence. They've actually done studies that correlate this kind of social environment with with higher levels of violence and societies in conflict. And so they realize that if you bring women back into the mainstream of society, give them jobs, they actually can help be a force of stabilization because they're raising their kids and in a more educated manner.
You write of several examples and several people, but one that struck me is Saima Mohammed. Tell us about Saima Mohammed.
Well, Saima is a very interesting woman in Pakistan, where she basically was beaten every day by her kind of deadbeat husband. He wasn't employed, so he would take his anger out on her. She had ended up having two girls, and after the second girl, her mother-in-law said to her son, "Why don't you take a second wife?" And so that made Saima feel even worse.
Take a second wife in order to get a
son. In order to get a son, yes. And so just at that moment, there was a micro-lending operation called Kashf who said, "Look, we'll give you $65. We'll lend you $65. Start a business." Saima thought about this. She is good at embroidery, so she started an embroidery business. When the merchants kept asking for more and she couldn't produce it, she started hiring other women to help do embroidery. Pretty soon she was hiring the whole village, and including her husband. She became the local tycoon. Her entire status was transformed, and now she's sort of like the breadwinner in the family, and the mother-in-law loves her.
And what happened to the husband in all of this?
Well, he has really changed. I asked him, "So what do you think about the idea of taking a second wife now?" And, "Oh, you know, I would never think about it." And
Why? Isn't the son still the cherished aim?
Well, he said, I asked him about having two daughters, and he said, oh, girls are just as good as boys. And now, I don't think that he truly believes that, but I think that he does appreciate Simon Moore because she put him out. She paid his debts. She was able to pay for a television, to pay for electricity to come to the house. And I think that he truly has modified his views to some degree. I asked his mother-in-law about wife beating. And the mother-in-law said something interesting. She said, well, you know, husbands truly should beat their wives when they disobey. But when a woman earns more than her husband, it's very hard for him to discipline her. And so you can really see these attitudes changing. And it's not just Saima who is the beneficiary of this. It's the entire family. It's their children who are being educated. And it's this entire community. And more broadly, it's Pakistan, which pretty desperately needs any kind of stability it can get.
Are you suggesting that this changes what we might call cultural norms?
Well, it really does help. I mean, look, I'm Chinese, and my grandmother's feet were bound. You know, now I look at my ancestral village, and what's happened is that there are no girls left in the village because they've all gone to the factories to work. You know, whether they are considered, you know, great jobs, they're not great jobs in our view, but they're great jobs for them because what a better alternative to work in a factory where you're actually earning an income than working in the field where you're not earning any income. And so I see that as their entire status has been elevated. You know, their grandparents had their feet bound, but now they themselves are breadwinning women who actually have a higher level of status in society.
The book's title, in fact, Half the Sky, comes precisely from a Chinese expression that women hold up half the sky. And I think sometimes there's a tendency for us to look at the just brutal oppression that happens in so many parts of the world and think it's hopeless, it's imbued in culture. And China is a pretty good response to that, because in China 100 years ago, it was just about the worst place in the world to be born female. There was child marriage, there was foot binding, concubinage, girls were not educated. And these days, for countries at its income level, it's one of the better places to be born female. And it is a result of a combination of education, economic opportunity that truly has changed that culture and just enormously helped all China as a result.
Now, frankly, some of what you write is very, very disturbing. You were talking here about economic opportunity and microfinance, but you also write about sexual slavery, sex trade, mass rape. What have you found?
Well, it is quite chilling. In our view, basically, the paramount moral challenge of this century is gender inequity. In the same way that in the 19th century, it was slavery. In the 20th century, it was totalitarianism. And now it's the brutality that is inflicted on so many people in so many countries because of their gender. If you look at over the past few decades, there are demographers who have said that 60 million to 100 million females are missing from the population.
Now you're right about the missing women, missing females. But what does that mean, just missing?
Well, you know, we always sort of tend to think that there are more females than males in the world, because in the U.S. there are more females in Europe, and women live longer than men. But in fact, worldwide, that is not true. Worldwide, there are more males than females, and that is because so many girls are, in a sense, discriminated against to death. They don't get the same access to health care, to food. They also, increasingly in India and China, when a woman is pregnant, she gets an ultrasound, and if she's carrying a female, then she gets an abortion, or sex-selective abortion. So,
how much does that happen? Does that happen a lot?
The sex ratio at birth in China, for example, is about 118 boys to 100 girls. That's a pretty huge disparity.
Yeah, it's unfortunately, the technology has given a lot of rural Chinese parents the means to you know, choose their baby boy or baby girl.
You know, you write something very interesting as I read the book, and you had a long excerpt of it in the New York Times Magazine section, and it prompts me as a journalist to really stop and sort of shudder, and that is, you know, arrest one dissident in Tiananmen Square, and you can plant a front-page story, and you can get political leaders around the world yelling and screaming about it. But these thousands of murders and other cases of oppression, you say, have gone largely unnoticed and are very difficult to get on the front page or the equivalent of it.
That was, in a sense, our awakening to this issue. We covered the Tiananmen Square massacres back in 1989. We were based there as reporters. And it was all over the front page, of course. And meanwhile, I think it was the next year, we came across a study that suggested that every year, 39,000 baby girls in China suffered this kind of discrimination to death. And we had never devoted one column inch to it. Well, maybe 500 people had been killed at Tiananmen, and that had filled the front page for months. And we really began to question what counted as journalism and where our priorities should be and what constituted news. And that led us to look more and more at these kinds of issues. And, I mean, at the millions of girls who also end up being trafficked into brothels and enslaved, and yet also is something we traditionally just don't cover.
Why?
I think it's because it's not a major event. It's a, you know, everyday occurrence. And the news tends not to focus on something that is an everyday occurrence because that's not new. And that's the problem. In India, throughout Southeast Asia, these are daily occurrences.
Is there also the sense that this is just sort of the way it is in these societies, that it's, in a sense, not news? It's just the unfortunate fallout from impoverished, rural, often rural, developing cultures?
That is definitely part of it. It's that they've grown accustomed to this kind of abuse, and that's. But that doesn't mean that the victims don't want it to happen. I mean, still want it to happen. They don't want it to happen.
Coming up, more of our conversation with Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudun. Half the Sky, turning oppression into opportunity for women worldwide. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, host of Planet Forward online and as seen on PBS, and director of the School of Media and Public Affairs over at the George Washington University, sitting in for Diane Rehm today. And we're talking with Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudun, the only married couple to win the Pulitzer Prize for their coverage in China as New York Times correspondents. That's quite a remarkable thing.
But it's no longer true. We were
the first married couple to win
a Pulitzer in journalism. But since then, there has been another couple here from Washington, Kevin Sullivan and Mary Jordan.
Okay, so stand corrected. The first married couple to win the prize. And congratulations for that. And also for this book, Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. We were talking about the disappeared women around the world, and we were talking about the cultural barriers that this whole issue faces. But I really would, as I said a little bit earlier, this issue of the sexual slavery to which many women are sold into or find themselves into, where do you find that most prevalent, and how do you change it?
It tends to be most prevalent in Southeast Asia, unfortunately. So in a place like Cambodia, and in India, and somewhat in Pakistan. And the solutions are, you know, they're complicated, but we have seen some progress. So, for instance, the TIP report is something that the State Department started implementing, and it was passed as law in 2000, and the Bush administration started implementing it. And it has been wildly successful. It's Trafficking in Persons Act. Basically, it forces countries to do something about trafficking, otherwise they face trade sanctions. And, you know, it actually has forced countries like Malaysia and countries that have to show progress that they're making in trafficking in persons. When we were in Cambodia, you know, the way it's implemented by the local countries is up to them. In a place like Cambodia, we were visiting a brothel that Nick had been to over the years, and the woman there...
As a reporter.
Yeah.
As a reporter, yes. Oh, yes.
Clarify that a little.
Yes. Well, when I was with him, actually, I was able to see for sure that this is something that he's actually been reporting on.
I'm one of the few people that was accompanied by his wife to brothels, and both of us with notebooks.
The brothel owner was very interesting. So, you know, we had thought she was this like crude woman who really just has no sort of soft bone in her body. But she was complaining about how the bribes had gone up. The policemen were really actually cracking down, and they were demanding much higher bribes, that it was making it not profitable for her to continue on in the brothel business. So she closed it down and opened a grocery shop.
That's what we need on a much bigger scale.
Gender-based violence, you say, is not so much about these individual thugs, and this, I think, illustrates in a sense, but sort of a culture of sexual predation. Explain what you mean. This culture is not individuals, but cultural.
Well, it's expected. It has become expected. Certainly, men think it is part of their right to demand sex, from women in brothels. And that's the problem: is that the culture has to change. When brothel owners see that there's a market for it, then they will continue to pursue it for profit. And so we believe that crackdowns really are very essential by the local authorities. We don't think that legalization of this phenomenon really helps. We think that you have to crack down.
And what do you find when you ask the legal authorities about cracking down?
Essentially, the law itself rarely matters. In Cambodia, for example, brothels have always been against the law. And, you know, in fact, I've visited brothels again, I hurry to add as a journalist, that were owned by the police.
Owned by the police?
Owned by the police. And that they have a better business model because then they don't have to pay bribes to the police if they're owned by the police. But what does work has been this kind of pressure from outside and from NGOs within the country that don't necessarily force the brothels to close down, but they put enough pressure on them that some people who maybe don't pay enough in bribes do get arrested. It raises the costs of trafficking girls, of kidnapping girls and selling them to brothels. It raises the risks of that. It raises the amount they have to pay. And some people do switch to stealing motorcycles instead, or fencing, you know, stolen goods, or selling pirated videos, and all that is good.
But when you've been in these countries and you've been talking to people in positions of authority and you put this out there as a moral issue, that these are human beings and they are being trafficked and they are being sold and they are being often drugged into addiction to engage in these behaviors, which themselves are risky and bad, how do people respond? How do people in authority respond to the fact that this is a daily occurrence?
Well, I think that one needs to really focus on a two-pronged approach, because the moral argument isn't going to resonate with a lot.
So that doesn't
exactly.
Doesn't resonate.
It doesn't resonate. You have to look at who your audience is. But what does resonate is something that really is focused on economic incentives, and that's the way to work with the local authorities or sanctions. I mean, that's why the TIP report works, because they get – well, again, that's an economic incentive.
Nicholas Kristof, when you looked at the sex trade in different parts of the world, what surprised you or what struck you the most?
I think one of the things that people don't often understand is that they think the problem is simply men. And in fact, it's much more complicated than that. So many of the brothel owners are women. So many of the traffickers who kidnap girls in rural areas are women. The people who cut girls' genitals, those are mothers. The men are often not part of that. The people who don't take their young women to the hospital when they're in labor. Those are the mothers-in-law. In India, a girl aged 1 to 5 is 50% more likely to die than a boy that age. 50% more likely. And one of the main reasons is that mothers are only half as likely to take their daughters to be vaccinated as to take their sons. I mean, in effect, there's a huge problem here with patriarchal attitudes, but women absorb and reflect those values and transmit them just as, or maybe not just as much as men, but to a huge degree.
To our listeners, if you'd like to have a question or join the conversation, you can do that by calling us at 1-800-433-8850 or sending your email to drshow@wamu.org. We're talking with Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn. We're talking about their book, Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. This issue that you've identified here also is disturbing in some ways, and you've got some chapters and some parts in your book that really took me aback. Without going into too much detail, for obvious reasons, you write about in South Africa someone who actually has come up with a device to, I don't want to say discourage rape, but that's what it is. I'll let you find the delicate way to talk about this.
This is where I want to hand off to Cheryl. this is a, you know, in South Africa, rape has been endemic.
This is an exceptional step that somebody's taken.
That's right. And, well, I just saw a survey that 25% of South African men acknowledge having raped a woman. So there was a reason this arose in South Africa. It's a device that a woman wears internally that if she gets raped, it injures the man. And it arose because authorities, governments, nobody has been terribly concerned with these issues of sexual violence that are endemic.
You know, admittedly, I mean, you know, she was criticized, the person who developed it was criticized, oh, this is just a medieval device. And she says, well, it's for a medieval crime.
Yeah. The other issue you write about, we've talked about the economic disadvantages so many women are in and sexual violence, is maternal mortality. You touched on this, but this is something I think people don't fully realize until they take this in its entirety.
Oh, basically, one woman dies each minute from maternal mortality, from child, you know, early childbirth, needlessly.
Just because of primitive medicine?
No, we actually, well, or lack of access to medicine or health care, because we have the means to, you know, prevent maternal mortality, you know, women dying when they're trying to give birth. But it's just there's no political will, and many women throughout Africa just don't have access to a clinic.
I mean, this overall is truly the cause of our times. When you have 500,000 women a year dying in a childbirth completely unnecessarily, when you have 10 times as many girls being transported each year into brothels as you had transported to plantations at the peak of the transatlantic slave trade, when you have 2 million girls in Africa having their genitals cut each year, you put all this together, you know, a couple of million girls going missing each year. This truly is both an extraordinary moral challenge, but also a phenomenal opportunity to fight poverty, to fight extremism. And we can change it. We know that.
And, you know, you say, and it's quite right, you put it all together and it also can be overwhelming, but it's the individual stories that break it out. It's the individual stories that prompt action. Tell us the story of Wapenshet. She's a Ethiopian, I believe. Is that right?
Wineshet, yes.
Wineshet,
yes. She's an Ethiopian girl, basically, who was raped. In that culture, basically, men find it, in order to avoid having to pay, a big a fee when they take a bride, they actually just rape the bride and then force her to marry him. And that's been an accepted practice. Well, Wineshet got raped by someone, and her parents and her family decided, no, she's just not going to marry him. And she didn't want to marry him. So she tried to fight it in the courts. He basically captured her. I mean, you know, did terrific things to her, but she went and she fought it in the courts. And a local court actually ruled in her favor. But she, you know, basically had to leave her village because she was determined, sort of an outcast.
So the court ruled in her favor, meaning what?
Well, they said that she didn't have to marry him. I mean, so it's not
yeah, right.
as though...
So what happened? So what happened to him?
Well, I mean, the series of things happened to him, but he's basically free. He's not in jail
so
for any reason.
So it's not court as we would think of it.
Right, right. It's, right. We're talking about local courts in the remote villages in Ethiopia. But it was a big victory, partly enhanced by an American nonprofit organization who wrote letters to the local authorities saying this is just unacceptable. And so the local courts ruled in her favor.
Yeah, and Americans really did help change this law in Ethiopia by supporting an Ethiopian aid group, the Ethiopian Women Lawyers Association. And so now if you do rape somebody in Ethiopia, then even if you marry her, that is not a defense. And there is now finally a little bit of disincentive to raping these girls in Ethiopia.
Yeah, I was going to ask
see
because
change.
It seems
you really
like,
do.
If it is it a sea change when a case like this comes along? What is the impact? Is the impact just in that village? Is it felt more widely? Is it something that changes behaviors or expectations?
Well, I mean, the most immediate impact is locally. It'll take a while to be disseminated, and then it depends on what's going to happen as it moves throughout the appeal court system. We certainly hope that it is going to have lasting change.
But one of the examples we talk about in Half the Sky is a woman in Pakistan called Mukhtar Mai, who, like so many Pakistani women, had been raped, but she was expected to commit suicide. She didn't. Instead, she prosecuted her attackers. They went to jail. And since then, she's become a role model for other women, and they are prosecuting their attackers, partly with her help. And as a result, now the rape rates have dropped in that area because now there is a real risk of raping young women.
You know, that brings up an interesting question. You mentioned Pakistan. Is there a country or a region where you've noted the most dramatic change, where women have made particular progress in the last 5, 10, 15 years?
One interesting example, especially as a counterpoint to Pakistan, is the country that used to be part of Pakistan, Bangladesh. Originally, I think anybody looking at Bangladesh would have thought it just had no hope and was much more forlorn than Pakistan. These days, it's in better shape than Pakistan, and I think part of that is because it made a real commitment to educating girls. These days in Bangladesh, there are actually more girls in high school than boys, and that help lay the groundwork for a huge garment industry in Bangladesh, help stabilize the economy, and is one reason why there is less extremism, less terrorism in Bangladesh than in Pakistan.
Of course, let there be no mistake. Bangladesh is an impoverished country.
It's a poor mess, but it's not as messy as Pakistan is.
I'm Frank Sesno, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join us to take part in this conversation, please call us at 1-800-433-8850 or send an email to drshow@wamu.org. And with that, we'll go to the call to the telephones now. Chuck from Germantown, Maryland, you're joining us. Thanks very much, and go ahead with your question.
Yes, good afternoon. I think this is an important topic. I myself am an independent human trafficking advocate, advocate against human trafficking. Since the start of the human slavery, anti-slavery movement, the modern slavery movement, I think there's been a lot of emphasis put on Asia, and especially Europe, Eastern Europe, after the fall of the Soviet Union. It's good that Africa is being highlighted. Certainly, I've followed Nicholas Kristof's stories in the Times over the years. So the area that I focus on is Latin America. I think it's important to focus right now, for example, on Mexico. If you look at Mexico, hundreds of thousands of women, and especially underage girls, are forced into sexual slavery. The southern border region of Mexico has been identified by Save the Children as the largest area of commercial sexual exploitation of children in the world. The International Organization of Migration estimates that of the women migrants from South and Central America who cross the southern Mexico border each day, 400 to 600 of them are raped.
Okay. Chuck, thank you very much. I want to turn your observation into a question to our guests, and that is, how much time did you spend or did you spend time in Latin America? What do you make of what Chuck has to say and what's being done about that?
We've spent less time in Latin America. We did some reporting on this in Central and South America, but rather less. Our take is that the single country where the problem is worst, both in the scale and in just the atrocities, is India. China has more prostitutes than any other country, but the girls aren't locked up in brothels there. In India, they are. They're kidnapped, locked up, and in India, as in contrast to a lot of other areas, the prostitutes are bred. They are forcibly they're forced to bear children, which will be a next generation of enslaved prostitutes, and the brothel owners often kill the girls that they control if they're disobedient. India really is the place I think we need to focus most on.
Cheryl, Mexico's on our borders.
Oh, actually, it definitely is true that this is an increasing problem in Mexico, and we need to put a stop to it as well. But India, just by sheer mass of population, is almost an overwhelming problem that needs to be tackled before it just gets to be worse.
Very quickly, when you say we need, meaning we?
You know, it needs an ecosystem. It's not just one or two people. It's not just the State Department. It has to be an ecosystem that has moved.
Coming up, more of your calls and questions for our guests. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the Pew Charitable Trusts, whose financial reform project provides analysis to guide the debate over financial modernization. At pewtrusts.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Max Blumenthal talks about his new book, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. He's been covering the right for 6 years. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane. Today we're talking about the book Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. The authors, Pulitzer Prize-winning Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudunn, both of them formerly from the New York Times. Now Nick is with the New York Times, and Cheryl is doing so many other things, including books like this. We have a number of questions that have come to us. We have some more callers we'll get to in a minute. But here's a provocative one from one emailer. Your guests failed to note the role of Islam in the subjugation of women. The Quran states that men are placed above women, and men are supposed to beat women who are persistently disobedient. True. And how do you address that?
It's true that if you look at countries where women and girls are less likely to be educated, where maternal mortality rates are disproportionately high for their income levels, where there are these kinds of problems, those countries are disproportionately Muslim, although not all Muslim countries have this problem. In our view, it is less about the Quran as such. I mean, after all, if you read Paul, he didn't think much of women either in the New Testament. But that Islam hasn't really modernized. That the Quran, when it was originally written, was an improvement for women, but that it hasn't modernized. There are some really interesting efforts by people who are called Islamic feminists right now to modernize the faith. It's still going to be a challenge to see how broadly that is accepted.
All right, let's go back to the phones here. We've got Kenny on the line with us. He's in Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, Kenny.
Hi, thank you for having me. I really appreciate this timely discussion about equality of women in the world. And while I feel that I completely agree with the guests that creating incentives that reward and incentives that punish governments for these acts against women, I also feel that this issue is also a moral issue. It's a great moral issue. And I'm a Baha'i, and as a Baha'i, one of our core beliefs are that the education of women is an issue, is a way in which this issue can greatly be addressed. To the extent that if in a family you have a man and a woman, a son and a daughter, and the resources are constrained, that the resources should go towards educating the women, because the women, so that the female is the first educator of the child. So I wanted to hear your guests to comment a little bit more. And I know they mentioned the situation of Bangladesh and how the education of women played an important role in liberating women in that country, but how governments across the world are putting constraints, incentives on various countries to address the issue of educating women more fully, so that equality between men and women can come about more readily.
Okay, thanks, Kenny.
The reason they focus on educating women is that research has shown that you just get more bang for your buck when you actually educate girls. And that's partly because when the girls grow up, if they continue their education, they tend to have kids later on in life, and they have fewer kids. So that tends to help, particularly in the developing world, that tends to help with population control. And the second thing is that they also, with more education, they raise their own kids better, and they spend more wisely. There has been research that has shown if you compare how a man spends when he controls the purse strings in the house to a woman who controls the purse strings in the house, the better spending decisions are done by the women. The men, top three or four things that they spend money on are alcohol, tobacco, candy, and festivals, whereas women, they spend it on their kids, the food, better food, health care. They will vaccinate the child and go send them to school. So that's why people focus on educating women.
That's why so much of the microfinance that's out there ends up in women's hands.
That's another reason. They found women, they get, again, more bang for the buck when they lend money to women. And that's because women tend to pay back their loans more, and they also spend more wisely in the businesses that they develop.
Nick Kristof, you're a columnist for the New York Times. So this question may, if it hasn't already prompted a column, may do so. And it comes from Jessica in Washington, D.C. And she asks, what should Secretary of State Hillary Clinton do to affect women's health, public safety, education, and economic equality? And how should U.S. foreign aid change? For example, sending less money for weapons and more for women's social programs and microcredit.
I think that those suggestions would all be very good. I mean, in Pakistan, after 9/11, we spent a total of $11 billion, we meaning American taxpayers, to Pakistan. That accomplished next to nothing. In contrast, if we had spent much more modest sums on education, including educating girls, on these kind of microfinance programs for women, it really would have had a much better effect on supporting the Pakistani economy, on defeating extremism. And I think I do think this is something that Secretary Clinton gets. I think it's something she's been interested in for a while. And I think she's also, I hope, going to put these issues higher on the agenda. I think her trip to Goma, Congo was really useful in that regard.
Well, there's a lot of talk in this town these days in this administration about smart power, right? Which is not
That's
just
right.
military, but it's also targeted economic aid. So how does smart power address these issues, or should it?
Well, and it's interesting that I think actually the Pentagon and Mike Mullen in particular, I mean, they really understand this. And so in Afghanistan, for example, the military is one of the major advocates for girls' education. And it seems kind of counterintuitive for them to be trying to fight the Taliban not only with bombs but with girls' education. But in fact, it is, and they do get that. And, you know, it doesn't actually take that much to get more girls in school. It's over and over we've seen a modest increase in resources that hugely improves the chances that girls can go to school.
Let's go back to the phones. Christine now joins us from Boca Raton, Florida. Hi, Christine.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is specific to China and more specifically to the fate of girls who are abandoned and then taken in at orphanages. My husband and I adopted a baby girl from China three years ago. And we've heard, frankly, horror stories about what happens to the girls once they become preteens, generally. And we are thinking about going back, and we just, the stories that we hear are just that. It's anecdotal, it's speculative, and we were wondering if your research and investigation has revealed the fate of these girls once they become older.
The fate of the orphans when they become older, you mean? Yeah. China still has a lot of problems. For all the progress that women have made in that society, alongside that, there still are a lot of rural attitudes that persist. I mean, China is a huge country, and so there is still parents who want to have a boy and they abandon their girl, and you know. If they're not adopted, then they do grow up in orphanages, and that's just a sad thing.
Yeah, we had a similar question from an emailer, Kathy, in Catonsville, Maryland, who says she adopted a baby girl from China in 2003 and asks whether things have changed in China with respect to preference for boys.
Oh, things are definitely changing, but China is such a vast country that it's going to take a long time for the entire country to change. In the cities, for instance, it's much more acceptable to have a girl, and in fact, some parents say they prefer to have girls over boys because they know that in their old age, their daughter will take care of them, their boy may not. But in the countryside, it is still there's still strong preferences to have boys.
Julie from Lyons, Michigan, you've been very patient, but thanks very much for joining us. Your question?
Oh, thank you for attacking this most important issue. I just wanted to make a point about this country and a culture that is prevailing through the entire world where women have always had to believe men's lies, and we've always been demonized for believing their lies. And instead of changing our culture in this country also to one where we respect each other, I don't see how we're going to change it in the rest of the world, but I sure do appreciate you trying. So thank you. I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, thanks very much. Who wants to go first?
Well, I mean, I guess I would say that there certainly are huge problems in the U.S. In all kinds of domains, whether they be in gender relations, in poverty, in health. And it is important, obviously, to focus on them. But at the same time, the challenges in other countries are so immense that I think it's a mistake to think that, well, we should first resolve the problems at home and then worry about them abroad. And we truly can really make a difference abroad. Sometimes we're accused of hypocrisy since we haven't solved our problems. But especially when we go and support foreign organizations, local organizations. In Afghanistan, in Half the Sky, we write about a woman who's educating Afghan girls, an Afghan woman. And this, an extraordinary person who stood up to the Taliban with secret schools, is now operating vast number of schools all over Afghanistan. People like that really do deserve our support.
Isar is on the phone with us from Crumpton, Maryland. Hi, Isar.
Yes, hi. what I want to say is when I appreciate the show, too, but I didn't appreciate the insult you framed into a question from a viewer, or supposedly a viewer, about Islam.
That was a question, an email
that was
question.
That was an insult. Anyways, it wasn't true either. You have 500,000 Westerners going to Thailand to basically rape children on their vacation. Wouldn't putting laws against that help? And also, when you keep referring to Afghanistan, it kind of reminds me of how the French rallied the masses when they were about to invade North Africa with the call of liberating the Muslim Arab women, and then turned around and mass raped them for basically decades on end to humiliate and basically extinct what they hoped would be an extinct race, which was the Arabians. And isn't this almost being used now as a humanitarian imperialism?
I see two questions there. You know, in terms of just laws, I think that laws are important, but they are not the only way to bring about change, because there are laws on the books that are just totally ignored. So you have to really focus on the practice. And so in Cambodia, you really have to get down on the ground and focus on cracking down on the sex trade there. In terms of your other issue, I think you're asking a question about cultural imperialism, right? In the fact that here are Americans going into a country and, you know, telling them what to do. We have to be very, very sensitive. And the best outcomes come about when Americans partner with local groups. And that's the way to bring about change.
You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. In our remaining minutes, we're going to go to some of the calls some more. 1-800-433-8850 to Ibrahim, who joins us from Washington. Hello, Ibrahim. Oh, Ibrahim.
This is Diane.
Go ahead. If you can turn, yes, it is. If you can turn your radio down, we'll take your question.
Okay, hold on, sir.
Okay,
well, what? You off? Yeah.
Go ahead with your question. We're a little short on time, so if you could make it succinct, we'd appreciate that.
I just like to make a comment. I'm Muslim, and I like to always make the analogy with Model T. When Henry Ford invented the Model T car, it was a revolution. And when Prophet Muhammad came with his message, it was a real revolution in the status of women and a lot of other things. However, we still have some Muslim extremists who would like to cling to the modern tea instead of modern cars.
Very interesting. What did you find?
I mean, I think that's a pretty good analogy. When, for example, the stipulation that Muslims can have four wives, that was a real improvement over the previous situation where polygamy was unlimited. And it was really meant as a way to ensure that the support for widows through remarriage. But it does need to be modernized further. And in the minds of some, although far from all Muslims, there is a tendency to be very, very reluctant to modernize.
In the minutes we have remaining, I want to come to another part of your book. It's a very important part, and it starts at the top of the page with four steps you can take in the next 10 minutes. You know, you cannot be a part of this conversation without being deeply disturbed by it, and many people may say, but it is so huge. It's half a world away. It's up against ingrained cultures and people who are desperately poor, and it sounds like Americans maybe marching in and trying to fix the world or preach to people as to how they should live. What can people do?
There are many small steps that people can take for starters, but the key is to start. So, for instance, go to kiva.org where you can actually browse and look at some of the businessmen who are asking for microloans. Go to givology.org or to globalgiving.org and see if there are projects that strike your fancy. But the main thing is, very simple steps that you can take are choose your foe. What kind of ailment ails? Is it something that you want to help? Is it maternal mortality? Is it sex trafficking? Or is it mass rape? And then choose your country. What country do you want to work with? And then choose your partner. What organization do you want to work with?
Focus.
Yeah, the you know, it's our impression that there are so many Americans who are troubled by problems abroad and want to help, but are worried about corruption, who think that foreign aid isn't effective, who think their money is going to support some huge aid bureaucracy. And there are real problems with aid effectiveness, but we've also, I think, identified a lot of groups that are making an extraordinary difference. And we wrote Half the Sky partly as a kind of do-it-yourself toolkit so people could. We also started a website, halftheskymovement.org, that lists a bunch of aid groups that are in this space. And, you know, we'd encourage people to look through them and find one that they identify with.
Finally, Nick, let me let you sign us off here in the less than a minute we have. You have many stories here. Many places you went, people you met. What's the most inspiring?
Maybe we talk about a woman in Zimbabwe named Tara Rai, who is one of my heroes. And she never got a chance to get an education because her family didn't think that girls should be educated. But she's incredibly bright. Her brother was sent to school, and she learned how to read from looking over his homework. And she would then do his homework for her. The teacher was suspicious when the brother was a poor student in class, turned in great homework. It was discovered. She went to school for a little bit. Then she wrote down her goals to study abroad, to get a graduate degrees. And she buried them, came here, dug up those things, checked off her goals, and now she's earning a PhD in the U.S.
Nicholas Kristof, Cheryl Udunn, Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. You've been listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno. Thanks for joining us.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.